Introduction. Osama bin Laden first registered as a substantial threat within the U.S. government in January 1996, when a specialized bin Laden unit was established at the CIA, the first time such a unit focusing on a particular individual had been set up within the agency. A year later, bin Laden gave his first television interview declaring war on the United States on CNN. Rarely have our enemies warned us so publicly of their intentions. Imagine for a minute that starting in 1937, the Japanese High Command repeatedly publicized its goal of attacking the United States. Surely, the U.S. Navy would have been more prepared for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Within 4 years of bin Laden's interview on CNN, Al-Qaeda had carried out the bombings of two U.S. embassies in Africa, an attack on the USS Cole in Yemen, and the 9/11 attacks, inflicting more direct damage on the U.S. than the Soviet Union had done during the 5 decades of the Cold War. To a large degree, this exponentially increasing campaign of violence was the result of one man's vision, Osama bin Laden. Just as an account of Nazism and its impact on Europe would be nonsensical without reference to the persona and worldview of Hitler, or a history of France after the Revolution of 1789 would make no sense without an understanding of Napoleon's goals and personality, so too our understanding of Al-Qaeda and the ideology it has spawned would be incoherent without reference to Osama bin Laden's personal story and his view of the world. Despite bin Laden's importance to the Al-Qaeda organization and to the larger ideological movement it has spawned, the conventional wisdom now is that tracking bin Laden down won't make much of a difference to the larger war on terrorism anyway. At a March 2002 press conference, President Bush referred to bin Laden as a person who's now been marginalized. Some have even joked that bin Laden is, in fact, been forgotten. Although it is certainly the case that the global jihadist movement will carry on whatever bin Laden's fate, it would be dangerously wrong to assume that it doesn't really matter whether he is apprehended. Finding bin Laden remains of utmost importance for 2 reasons. First, every day that bin Laden remains at liberty is a propaganda victory for Al-Qaeda. Second, although bin Laden and his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, don't exert day-to-day control over Al-Qaeda, they do continue to supply broad strategic guidance for the group's actions and for those of its affiliates. Statements from bin Laden and al-Zawahiri have always been the most reliable guide to the future actions of jihadist movements around the world. This has remained the case even while both men have been on the run. Indeed, since the 9/11 attacks, bin Laden has released at least 18 statements on video or audio tape, which have reached audiences of tens of millions as those statements are relayed around the globe by the BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera, and other television networks. Arresting the spread of bin Laden's ideas will prove more problematic than arresting or killing Al-Qaeda's leaders. One indicator of this is a worldwide opinion poll undertaken by the Pew Global Attitudes Project in March 2004. The Pew poll found that bin Laden is viewed favorably by large percentages in Pakistan, 65%, Jordan, 55%, and Morocco, 45%, all key allies in the war on terrorism. The results of the 2004 Pew poll are similar to a 2003 Pew poll in which Indonesians, Jordanians, Pakistanis, and Moroccans all expressed more confidence in bin Laden than in President Bush, by large pluralities. Indeed, not since Egypt's President Gamal Abdel Nasser galvanized the Middle East in the 1950s and 1960s with his vision of Arab nationalism married to socialism, has an Arab political figure had as much impact on the world. An indicator of bin Laden's continued ideological importance to the militant jihadists is that in 2004, the most feared insurgent commander in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, pledged his allegiance to al-Qaeda's leader. Given the impact that bin Laden has had on the recent history of the world, there is surprisingly a good deal that remains mysterious about him. How did he develop into the leader of the world's most deadly terrorist organization? And how did he conceive of the religious political ideology that will be his legacy? Is he a rich wannabe jihadist who became the pawn of Egyptian Islamist militants? Or is he his own man? To what extent has Al-Qaeda acted as a top-down organization run by bin Laden, or has it always been more of a loose ideological movement? Is bin Laden's fight against the West the petulant act of a quixotic millionaire, or the carefully thought-out strategy of a man who believes he is fighting for the very survival of true Islam? Is he attacking the United States because of its freedoms or its foreign policies? Finally, what does bin Laden really want? The overthrow of the Saudi regime or the restoration of the caliphate across the Muslim world? I do not pretend that this book will definitively answer those questions. After all, the interior life of any one person is something of a mystery. And writing about bin Laden is complicated by the fact that he grew up in one of the most closed societies on the planet, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and is himself a scion of one of the kingdom's most secretive families. Moreover, he has seemingly deliberately avoided revealing much of his personal story when he's been interviewed. However, I hope I have elicited, in scores of interviews and a search of many archives and databases, something that will help you develop a fuller picture of the man and his organization. My intent is not to perform an exercise of what the French term « tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner ». To understand everything is to forgive everything. What bin Laden has done is unforgivable. But bin Laden is a man, and we need to understand him neither through a fog of our own propaganda. He has never, for instance, expressed an interest in attacking the West because of our freedoms, nor through the mythomania of his supporters, who style him as the defender of Islam, despite the fact that the Quran is full of injunctions against the killing of civilians. As you listen to this book, maybe bin Laden will remain forever a sphinx without a riddle, an enigmatic smile playing on his lips, or perhaps he will emerge as something fuller. In an effort to try and fill in some of the gaps about bin Laden, I decided to write an oral and document-based history of bin Laden using the words of those who have some personal insights about him, whether that was through one chance meeting or years of deep friendship. Everyone quoted in this book, with a few exceptions that are noted in the text, has actually met bin Laden, ensuring that the stories told are first-hand accounts and are neither filtered through the recollections of others nor through the tsunami of nonsense that's been written about him, such as that as a teenager he was partying in Beirut, or that Al-Qaeda had an alliance with Iraq's former leader, Saddam Hussein. My decision to limit the people we hear from in this book only to those who have met bin Laden is something of a device, but I believe it's a useful one. The fact that someone has actually encountered bin Laden is a good indicator that person probably has something important to say about bin Laden himself and or Al-Qaeda's roots, history, and future. Of course, this book is not a series of dozens of accounts of someone's first meeting with bin Laden, which would become boring quickly. Rather, the meeting with bin Laden is, in most cases, simply a launching point for a wider discussion of bin Laden's character, the personalities of his inner circle, and Al-Qaeda's history and goals. I hope this history of bin Laden will illuminate worlds of which the reader is likely to have little experience. For instance, the time and place where bin Laden grew up, Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in the 70s, where Al-Qaeda slowly took shape, Afghanistan during the Soviet War in the 80s, where bin Laden became more radicalized, Sudan in the mid-90s, also Afghanistan under the Taliban in the late 90s, and finally, the secretive world of Al-Qaeda itself. To tell the stories in this book, I have relied on interviews I have conducted over the past 8 years in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, Yemen, and the United Kingdom. I've also incorporated material from people who know bin Laden from legal cases in the United States, Canada, Italy, France, Bosnia, Belgium, Spain, Germany, and Egypt. And I have mined books written by Al-Qaeda's leaders and former Taliban officials. Thousands of pages of transcripts of U.S. military tribunal proceedings of prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay. First-hand accounts of bin Laden from newspapers from around the Muslim world. Documents from the Saudi bin Laden group and a trove of al-Qaeda-related documents and publications going back to the mid-80s that I have collected over the years. A key discovery among those al-Qaeda-related publications was several thousand pages of the Jihad magazine, which was the in-house organ of the Arab jihadists based in Pakistan during the 1980s. West Point's Counterterrorism Center also made available its translation of thousands of pages of the Encyclopedia of Jihad, al-Qaeda's vast internal manual that was largely written during the 1990s. I've also used statements from bin Laden himself, such as those he made to CNN's Peter Arnett and myself in March 1997 when we interviewed him in Afghanistan for his first television interview, the only time that I met al-Qaeda's leader. The personal detail that most forcefully struck me when we met bin Laden was how he presented himself as a soft-spoken cleric, rather than as the fire-breathing leader of a global terrorist organization. During the course of our interview, bin Laden's tirade against the West was delivered in a voice that barely rose above a whisper. It was also clear that bin Laden was well informed about world events. He mentioned, for instance, that the former IRA terrorist leader, Gerry Adams, had recently met with President Clinton at the White House. This off-the-cuff comment, made in the middle of the night in a hut on a cold Afghan mountaintop, has always stayed with me as an example of bin Laden's intense interest in world politics. It's these kinds of insights and anecdotes about bin Laden that I hoped to elicit in my interviews with those who have spent time with him. At the same time, I also wanted to derive a better account from the inside of the nature of the al-Qaeda organization. As I was gathering interviews and material for the book, one theme started emerging rather forcibly. The whole history of al-Qaeda, much of Afghanistan's history over the past two decades, and even the events of 9/11 itself, are in some senses reflective of the ideological and military struggles between bin Laden and the legendary Afghan commander Ahmad Shah Massoud. Not only was there personal enmity between the two men, but they are also both representative of the ideological civil war that is taking place today in the Muslim world. Between those like bin Laden, who want to install Taliban-style theocracies from Indonesia to Morocco, and those like Massoud, who have aimed to create Islamic states that enjoy friendly relations with the West, are tolerant of other religions, and are amenable to women having a role outside the home. In 1993, during Afghanistan's civil war, I met Massoud at his headquarters north of Kabul, and like so many others, I was struck by his intense integrity and charisma. Massoud was arguably the most brilliant military strategist of the late 20th century, surviving six major Soviet operations during the 80s aimed at defeating him in his sanctuary in the Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan. Yet in person, Massoud projected a kind of gentle fragility and a disarming sense of humor. The experience of meeting Massoud was quite a powerful sensation and was very different from the experience of meeting bin Laden, whom I found opaque and hard to read. Massoud and bin Laden never met, but as one of the interviewees in this book perceptively observes, if they had done so, the recent history of the world might well have turned out differently. While Massoud was what most Westerners would term a fundamentalist, his was a moderate kind of fundamentalism, which was leavened by an interest in the poetry and mysticism of Sufism, tolerance for others, and an orientation towards the West. Beginning in the late 80s, bin Laden and the Egyptians who would form the core of al-Qaeda turned against Massoud, at the same time embracing a highly radicalized Islamism that branded Muslims who did not share their militant jihadism as apostates. Beginning in the late 80s, al-Qaeda would ally itself with Massoud's bitter rival, the Afghan commander Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. And in the late 90s, al-Qaeda would join forces with the Taliban, which faced its only serious opposition from Massoud's forces, who resisted the Taliban for more than 5 years. The story of the enmity between bin Laden and Massoud would climax with Massoud's assassination on September 9, 2001, which historians will record as the curtain raiser for the 9/11 attacks 2 days later. The assassination had been personally ordered by bin Laden and was a gratuity to Taliban leader Mullah Omar, whom bin Laden did not clue in on his 9/11 plans, which Mullah Omar would have likely opposed on the grounds that such an act threatened his regime. Another theme that emerged as I was reporting this book is the extent to which bin Laden acts on impulse, often overreaching and paying little attention to the potential consequences of his actions. In some cases, this trait might indicate decisiveness. Most of the time, it indicates foolhardiness and egotism. Bin Laden, for instance, did not wait for a fatwa to be issued about the necessity of fighting against the Soviets when they invaded Afghanistan on December 25, 1979. At the age of 22, bin Laden went to Pakistan within weeks of the invasion and started fundraising for the Afghan war effort. While other Arabs involved in the jihad against the Soviets saw it as their mission to play a supporting role to the Afghan Mujahideen, between 1986 and 1987, bin Laden set up his own entirely Arab military force to fight the Soviets. That force took on Soviets at the Battle of Jajji in the spring of 1987. However, while the Arab military engagement at the Jajji battle, much like the 9/11 attacks a decade and a half later, brought a great deal of publicity to bin Laden, neither turned out to be smart strategy. Which brings us to an important point. Bin Laden certainly attempts to think strategically. For instance, creating his Arab force that would not retreat from the Soviets, or later attacking the far enemy, the United States, in an effort to destabilize the near enemy, Saudi Arabia. But what are the fruits of his strategic thinking? The Battle of Jajji showed the Arabs could hold off a larger number of Soviets for a period of a few weeks. Nothing more. 9/11 showed that al-Qaeda could attack the United States itself, but it turned out to be something of a kamikaze mission for bin Laden's organization, as the American response to the attacks was to decimate al-Qaeda and destroy its Taliban partners. Similarly, in 1989, bin Laden insisted on participating in the attack on the city of Jalalabad in eastern Afghanistan, despite the fact that such an attack did not play to the strengths of his small guerrilla army. The attack turned out to be a fiasco, and around 100 of his Arab mujahideen were killed. And against the advice of several of his associates, as the war against the Soviets was winding down, bin Laden set up his own organization to continue fighting jihads around the world, al-Qaeda. Bin Laden would continue to act impulsively after the war against the Soviets. When Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in 1990, bin Laden immediately offered to set up his own mujahideen force to defeat the Iraqis, an idea the Saudi government dismissed out of hand. After 1996, while bin Laden was based in Afghanistan, he gave interviews to several international media organizations calling for attacks on the United States, despite the fact that the Taliban had repeatedly put him on notice not to do so. And then, of course, he presided over the 9/11 attacks, which had the unintended effect of obliterating the Taliban regime and destroying al-Qaeda's extensive infrastructure in Afghanistan. Perhaps because we constantly hear that Islamist terrorists are bound together by their common dislike of the United States, we tend to assume that they must also be united by common tactics, strategies, and ideology. In fact, they often resent one another as much as they do the Bush administration, and the global jihadist movement is riven by squabbles over personnel and strategy. One key theme that emerges from this book is how fissured and split the jihadist movement has been historically, and how those fissures became even more pronounced as a result of the 9/11 attack, which many Islamist militants have concluded did damage to their cause. I have tried to exclude materials from the book that are either of questionable authenticity or impossible to verify. There is, for instance, a marvelous gossipy interview with bin Laden's fifth wife, a Yemeni, that was published in the Saudi Majalla magazine in 2002. The article claimed that bin Laden's former wife had returned to Yemen from Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban, a claim that's dismissed by Abu Jandal, bin Laden's chief bodyguard and a reliable source of information about al-Qaeda's leader. Likewise, a lengthy screed, which first surfaced in November 2002, Osama bin Laden's letter to America, purports to be from al-Qaeda's leader. The letter decries everything about the United States, from its stance on global warming to its supposed tolerance of incest. However, it is dismissed as a fake by those familiar with bin Laden's style, such as the Palestinian journalist Jamal Ismail, who has known al-Qaeda's leader since 1984. It is also my judgment that the letter is not from bin Laden, as it rants on about a number of issues, such as AIDS, gambling, and the American sex trade, that bin Laden has never discussed in any of his scores of other statements. Moreover, unlike a bin Laden audio tape or videotape, a letter posted to a website claiming to be from al-Qaeda's leader, as this one was, cannot be independently verified. Obviously, some of the people I'm quoting in the book may have self-serving versions of events, and some may even be lying. Where that's the case, readers should be able to detect it, either because of the circumstances in which those statements were made, or because of information supplied by other interviewees elsewhere in the book. Clearly, a detainee held at Guantanamo is likely to put an innocent gloss on his activities, while former officials in the Sudanese government may have developed amnesia about the close relations they enjoyed with bin Laden during his 5-year sojourn in Sudan. I have excerpted a variety of documents in this book. They are generally from court proceedings from around the world, but there are also a myriad of other sources, such as U.S. State Department cables and books written by al-Qaeda insiders.